Imaginary friends. You may have had one as a child or gone to school with children who did. My next guest is an American school teacher and an author who had an imaginary friend named Johnson Johnson. The friend was so real to Matthew Green that he was completely surprised many years later when his mother told him that Johnson Johnson never existed. The experience has stuck with him, and his latest book is called Memoirs of an Imaginary Friend. To tell us more, Matthew Green is on the line from Connecticut. Hi, Matthew, how are you?
Hi, great. Thank you so much for having me.
Look, tell us more about Johnson Johnson. Do you have any idea how old you were when he came to be?
Well, my mother guessed he probably came around the time I was 3 or 4 years old and lasted for 3 or 4 years after that, so later than, you know, most imaginary friends.
But I guess being that little bit older perhaps meant that he could be more fully formed, if you know, because you were that much older to be able to create him, which is sort of one of the things you look at in the book, really. How real was he to you?
He was very real. My family would take in foster children for, 4 or 6 weeks at a time. So, you know, I just assumed as a child that he had been one of those foster kids who stayed with us a lot longer than the rest. It's so odd that even today when I think back on my childhood, I'll come upon a memory that I haven't thought about in, 20 years, and Johnson Johnson will still be in the memory, and I'll have to stop and remind myself that he wasn't really there, and I sort of have to scrub him from my memory constantly.
Oh, goodness. He wouldn't like that, you know. He wouldn't like to be scrubbed from your memory, would he?
No, he wouldn't. We were very good friends for a long time, and it was really sad for me to find out that he wasn't real.
Any ideas how you came up with the name Johnson Johnson?
My mother said Johnson & Johnson's baby powder was probably, I heard the name a bunch of times probably as a baby because I had younger brothers and sisters, so probably where the name came from.
One of the things that we uncover in the book, because we see this from the imaginary friend's perspective, and I found this enchanting, is that some children imagine their imaginary friends are very real and very detailed, you know, the detail from the hair on their head through to what they're wearing through to the toes, and others are less well formed. Was Johnson & Johnson like perfectly formed from your memory?
Yeah, he was really just a, from my memory, what I remember of him now, he was a perfectly formed boy, a little taller than me, a little older than me. But otherwise, very much like me, and someone I turned to a lot when I was a kid.
So how did your parents respond? Because I guess you had conversations with Johnson Johnson. They were aware of him, obviously.
Yeah, they were. I had sort of absentee parents to a great degree. I had a brother and a sister and a stepbrother and a stepsister, but my parents... It was the 1970s, and I guess parenting might have been different then. So as a kid, I did a lot of the parenting. I was babysitting at an age, that was unheard of today. And I think probably I was looking for someone to turn to occasionally for some help in taking care of my brothers and sisters. And, they were always asking me as a kid, what should we do next? What should we do next? And I suspect that because I was always that person to make those decisions for them, that I decided maybe I needed somebody to help me make those decisions. But my parents thought it was funny, and I think they thought it kind of endearing. And, I asked my mother later when he went away, and she really wasn't sure. She said that he seemed to be more sporadic as I got older, and then one day I just stopped talking about him.
You know, the sad thing is that I can imagine that kind of behaviour perhaps these days when there's so much focus on children's behaviour and do they have, ADHD or any of these many conditions that they seem to talk about. That could have been seen as a bad thing, as abnormal behaviour. So was it helpful, do you think, in reflection, that you folks just let it go?
Yeah, I do. I think overall I would have preferred a little more parenting from them, to be honest. But I think that when I think back on my childhood, he really enriched my childhood. Now, it's very odd because when I say that, I really, once again, I fall into the habit of thinking he was real. But I would not like to think of my childhood without Johnson Johnson for that period of time. So I'm glad they let it go, and I'm glad that I was able to, foster that. And it created a great book. So they didn't know that at the time, but it ended up being something I'm really proud of.
How old were you when I mentioned before that your mum, I think it was, said to you, actually, Johnson & Johnson wasn't real, wasn't one of the foster kids who lived with you or a friend. And how old were you when that happened?
I was about 12. I had gone to a, we had gone to a zoo when I was younger, and Johnson & Johnson had been with us. So I was trying to get my mother to bring us back to the zoo, and I said to her, "Remember, we played in the Japanese gardens. I remember I was playing tag with Johnson & Johnson." And then she stopped me and said, "You realize he wasn't real?" And we went back and forth for quite a while, me insisting that he was real and she insisting that he wasn't. So I took some convincing to, you know, I remember going to my stepfather and saying, you know, "He was real, right?" And, you know, my brothers and sisters. And after a while, I finally came to terms with it.
It's a bit like learning that, and I hope no children are learning, you know, those who doubt the existence of Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy. Did it have that kind of impact on you?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, except for the fact that I spent so much time with him. You know, I still, even at 10 years old, I teach 10-year-olds. There are those that believe in Santa Claus still, and I think it's easy to believe in him because you don't actually have to spend any time with him, you know, and even with the Tooth Fairy. But it was especially difficult thinking that you spend so much time and thinking you have a friend and then discovering that friend was just sort of something you made up in your head.
So essentially it was like losing a friend, wasn't it?
It was.
Losing the memory of a friend, yeah.
Yeah.
You don't remember no longer having Johnson & Johnson in your life. I think you said maybe about six or so when he stopped being an imaginary friend. Do you have any idea if anything triggered that or how that was for you with him no longer being there?
I don't. I mean, my only guess is I started going to school when I was five, and I know kindergarten was a little difficult for me. I just remember being, a kid who didn't quickly make friends. And it took me about a year to sort of figure out how that worked. So I suspect that, you know, probably in first grade when I was about six, I started to make some friends that weren't my brothers and sisters, and that's probably when Johnson & Johnson left me.
Now, you're a teacher now. Do imaginary friends still exist?
Not for my students. You know, the youngest I've taught is seven and the oldest is 10. So I've never had a kid who's actually acknowledged it to me. I have friends who have kids. And actually, Budo's name comes from the name of a friend's imaginary friend. Friends of mine have twins, and they actually have shared imaginary friends, which I thought was fascinating. And they had an imaginary friend named Budo, so I used that name for the character in the book.
See, I think that's kind of nice to know, because these days kids have so much, you know, thrown at them, don't they, and so much on screen and so much reality around them, that I kind of think that's really healthy, that imaginary friends still exist, that there's room for that kind of creativity and imagination these days.
Yeah, I like it. I have a three-year-old now, and she hasn't expressed any interest in imaginary friends or pointed any out to me yet, but I won't be sad if she does.
Oh, sure. Well, it's one thing to have, you know, been traversing these memories of an imaginary friend, but how did the book come about?
Well, I told the story of Johnson & Johnson to a student teacher I was working with. We were at recess one day, and she told me that would make a great book, a story told from an imaginary friend's perspective, and I thought she was crazy. Well, I've written two books before this one, and they were very grounded in realism and about relationships and the way people get along. So this wasn't a book I would have imagined myself writing. But when I get ready to write a new book, I send my ideas to my agent. I'm fortunate to have a bunch of ideas for books and just not enough time to write them. So she tends to point me in the right direction. And so I happen to put the imaginary friend idea on the list, just, you know, because I put all the ideas on the list. And she jumped on it right away. And we went back and forth a bit, and I actually ended up starting the book out of spite. I told her I would give her 2 months with the book, and when I proved her right and did a bad job with it, then we would move on to something else. And as is the case in my life, the women of my life are always correct, so things worked out very well.
There's an irony here. I think I've read that you work from character. So once you had imagined Budo, you know, you had another imaginary friend in your life, really. It went from there. So it wasn't the plot, it was the characters?
Yeah, with all the books I write, once I find a character, they just sort of lead me through the story. And the plot, it sounds crazy, but the plot just sort of falls out onto the page once I find the character. It's not the way I would like to write books, to be honest with you. I'd like to be the clever author who constructs his own twists and turns and takes credit for the, you know, the clever plot angles I develop. But I just write, and the plot just seems to come about once I find that character.
When you were writing it, did you have that kind of crossover market? Because a lot of adults really enjoy books in the young adult market. They can be really quite exciting, you know what I mean? We do a lot of this because of crossover now. Was that in your mind, that you're writing both for young people and for grown-ups?
It really wasn't. I thought I was writing for adults. In fact, I was a little worried that it was becoming a children's book at times, and my agent kept assuring me that, you know, it was still directed at adults. I was hoping that I would end up with a book that my students could read. My first two books, the first one my students are allowed to read if their parents approve, and the second one they're not allowed to read even if their parents do approve. But I was hoping that this would be a book that my fifth graders, my 10-year-olds could, you know, pick up and I wouldn't worry too much about. And I came close. There's a couple scenes in the book that I would advise parents to read first in case they get questions, and there's a little bit of language, but I think it's close. I think it's something I would encourage most of my 10-year-olds to read.
It's also the kind of book, because of what you're dealing with here, Matthew, that invites readers' stories. Have you been flooded with people wanting to share with you the stories of their own imaginary friends?
I have. It's been really great, to be honest with you. It's one of my favorite parts of the whole process. It hasn't been published here in the U.S. until August, so, you know, I'm a bit detached for the first time in terms of my book being in stores and being on shelves and hearing from readers directly here in the U.S., but through Twitter and through email, I've gotten lots of stories about imaginary friends, and readers have even been kind enough to, like, take pictures of the book in bookstores for me because they know I can't get to the bookstores where it's popping up right now. So it's really been wonderful, and I've got some great imaginary friend stories. I kind of wish I had them when I was writing the book because they're more imaginative than anything I could come up with.
Well, we've talked a little bit about Budo, but I wanted to talk about Max, who created him. And always when you're talking to a novelist, you're trying to find the similarities between the writer and the one of the protagonists here. But Max's life sounds very different to your life.
It does. I mean, I think I'm much more close to Budo than I am to Max. But I've known a lot of Max's being a teacher. I work in a school that has a program for special needs children, and that includes autistic and children who have Asperger's. And then there's just lots of kids who are, we call them spectrum-y kids. They're, you know, they don't have a diagnosis, but they're just a little different than your typical child. And so I've had a lot of those kids in my life through my years of teaching.
Your heart goes out to Max. I mean, everything's kind of against him, really, isn't it? He's a lonely kid. He's struggling. He's bullied. You know, his parents are relatively supportive, I guess, but it's a tough life for this wee fella. You can understand why he needed a friend, because he doesn't have any in the real world.
It's true. You know, I've always been fascinated with the idea that we encourage children to be themselves and to avoid peer pressure and to find their own path in life. And then I think as adults, the ones that listen to us often get punished for being different than everybody else. And I often wonder with kids like Max, you know, in the book, Max sort of wants to be alone. His friend is Budo, and he's not interested in a lot of other people. And we as teachers and parents sort of want our kids to be social and to have lots of friends and meaningful relationships. And sometimes I wonder if kids like Max, their form of happiness is not what we think of as happy, and maybe these kids would be better off if we let them, you know, be happy in the way they are rather than the way we expect them to be. So I liked thinking about Max in that regard and playing with the idea that, you know, this boy could just be happy if everyone would kind of leave him alone and let him be who he is and let him grow at his own pace.
It also means that Budo has a great sense of responsibility for Max. I mean, not just because his survival essentially relies on Max believing in him and imagining him, but he has a purpose to being there to help this young fella.
Yeah, he does. And I guess that was probably a little bit of the way I thought of Johnson Johnson as being the person that I looked to a much greater degree. Budo has a deep sense of responsibility for Max. And part of the tension is the book is the balance between his personal survival, Budo keeping Max, you know, alive and safe for his own good, and also keeping Max safe for Max's good and for the love of Max. And Budo fights with those two things because they don't always match up, as it happens in life. Sometimes our personal interests and the interests of others don't always work to be the same.
You know, I had that kind of fear from the start for Budo that you have with, say, Puff the Magic Dragon or sometimes the Toy Stories, you know, this need for children to have an interest or to believe. And once they stop believing or they don't need their toys anymore, they're moved on to something else, that things are left behind. So I guess for us, we believe that Budo's time is limited. Budo believes that his time is limited. And it gives you that kind of feeling in the pit of your stomach, you know?
Yeah, it does. You know, when I was younger, I've survived a couple near-death experiences that were just really unfortunate. And as a result, one of the things that I live with sort of constantly on an hour-by-hour basis is it's not often that I'm not reminded that I'm mortal and that there will be an end to this at some point. And in many ways, the existential dilemma that Budo fights throughout the book is something that I live with all the time, the constant reminder that there's going to be an end to this someday. So me and Budo are most alike when it comes to that, to our concern for our own existence.
You mentioned before that you had a tough childhood and being the eldest and having step siblings and the responsibility that came with that. And you spoke about your mum and your stepdad. What was the situation with your father? And I'm wondering if you look back, that separation between your parents might have been partly at least behind the evocation of Johnson & Johnson.
Well, my parents, I think Johnson & Johnson was born prior to the divorce, prior to the separation, but he lived through it. So his persistence may have, been the result of the separation and divorce of my parents, but it wasn't the impetus for it. My mother and father divorced, and unfortunately my father and I lost touch very quickly, and we stayed out of touch actually until my first book was published. When that book came out, my aunt sort of used it as a venue to bring the two of us back together, and we've been sort of forging a relationship as best we can since then. But I didn't have very much of a relationship with my father growing up, so that was an unfortunate thing. But maybe Johnson & Johnson was there a little bit for that as well.
I've also read that you've died twice. Has that influenced how you live your life?
I wish I could say it had. I had an experience when I was 8. I'm allergic to bees, and I was stung for the first time. And when the paramedics arrived, my heart had stopped, and I wasn't breathing anymore. And then when I was 17, I was in a car accident, and I ended up going through the windshield, and the same thing had happened. I was on the side of the road, and the paramedics found me, without respiration or a heartbeat. And I still remained a procrastinator as a result. When I was about 22, I was robbed at gunpoint in this really horrible situation. And it was that sort of set me on a path of constant forward progress and maximum productivity at all costs. So I like to think the universe was trying to wake me up, and unfortunately for me, it took 3 big knocks on the head before I finally realized that I needed to get moving in life.
Oh, my goodness. I understand you don't really like to sleep, which is probably understandable.
No, I never slept very much. My mother said that there was never a time when I was sleeping when she went to bed, and there was never a time when she woke up and I was still sleeping. So I've never been a big sleeper anyway, and then after the robbery, I had post-traumatic stress disorder for about 10 years, and that leads to a lot of nightmares, and that just discourages you from sleeping anyway. So I don't like, nowadays, I just don't like sleep because I find it terribly unproductive. I often think about it as human beings' greatest weakness in life is our need to sleep. So I try to get enough sleep, but fortunately for me, that's 4 or 5 hours a night, so I can get a lot done.
Well, that's handy for you having a 3-year-old and I think a baby due in June, is that right?
Yes, it is. It's very handy. I get a lot of work done from 4 to 7 o'clock in the morning and a lot of work done late at night after everyone's gone to bed.
Now, you're still working and writing. Do you hope to be able to write full-time someday?
I've always said that I would like to teach for pleasure and write for a living. And I'm not there yet, but I love teaching. I love the kids. And it hasn't gotten in the way of the writing yet. And publishers don't like more than one book a year. And the way things have been going, I've been able to write a book a year while still teaching. So there'll come a time, I think, probably when writing can fully take the place of teaching. To be honest with you, it's golf, really, that will get me to retire from teaching. My desire to play golf every day will cause me to eventually leave the classroom. I don't think it'll be the writing.
Oh, well, good luck with the book. We'll be talking to Matthew Green. This is the author of Imaginary Friends. He was talking to us from Connecticut. And Memoirs of an Imaginary Friend is published by Sphere. It's delightful.